All right, welcome back, everyone. The schedule I put up had last week's guided meditation written out. There was no guidance during this meditation, so hopefully that wasn't too confusing for you. And I hope everyone is staying healthy and both of mind and body these days. And those of us who are healthcare providers, I hope you're finding some place of balance with the intense demands or any other essential business you might have. All right, so tonight I'd like to continue with this exploration of dependent origination. The Buddha once said that whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dharma, and whoever sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. So such a concise statement that brings the importance of this dependent origination to the forefront. It's a key teaching. It's really a fundamental teaching. One way to describe it, it's the second noble truth. It's the origination of suffering. What causes suffering to arise, to become visible in our experience. And so this year, as you know, we're exploring the dependent origination one link at a time. And we hope that as teaching this, you start to understand each link by itself, how it functions, how it manifests itself, how we can start to take it apart, how each link interrelates with the other links and creates this process of suffering, this process of selfing. Suffering and selfing are really one in the same. And also each link can provide a point of practice, something that we can really highlight and see how that shows up, not only in our formal practice, but also in the nitty-gritty of our daily lives, the nitty-gritty of dealing with this new state of the world and how we can adapt to that and how can we meet that with our practice. So in this way, each link becomes this foothold that allows us to connect with our practice and ultimately with life. And really what we do with that foothold is interrupt this cycle of dependent origination, cycle of samsara, to find this little bit of a chink in the armor, a chink in the process to release this process of selfing, this process of suffering. So this month, we turn toward Nama Rupa, which also is translated as name and form. Nama Rupa, or name and form. Now, we can go in a very technical direction with this, but I'm going to try to make it very practical. Just as a quick aside, that often Nama Rupa is considered connected with the five aggregates. These five aggregates, to quote the suttas, and what is name and form? This is quoting the Buddha. Feeling, perception, intention, contact, and attention. This is called name. The four great elements and the form dependent upon the four great elements. This is called form. It's form and name and form are really the five aggregates is one way to look at that. But the way I like to look at it and the way I like to hold it as a practice point of name and form of Nama Rupa is that when we perceive anything through any of the sense doors, through our minds, through our noses, through our ears, through our bodies, we perceive something through a sense door, our minds prescribe a label to it. It says, oh, I know that's a dog. I know that's a cat. That's a flowering rose, cherry blossom, a camellia. There's this label that the mind offers, a name. And to that form, we also like to think, you know, we add a label to that form. And we like to think that that label is neutral, is kind of an accurate and unbiased description of reality. But with even a kind of a shallow look, we can see how that's not so. That very much embedded in the very name of something, the neighbor label in our label is a whole relationship to it. our whole history around it, our memories, our actions around that particular object comes forth in that label. So the label isn't just the name, it also has this quality of what we're going to do with that experience, with that sense data. So nama rupa, this linking of these two. So embedded in the label, in the name of something, like that's a dog, for example, in the label is also the sense of me who's perceiving that. The sense of me and my relationships to dogs, for example. And further embedded in that is this action. What am I going to do with that? Am I going to call that dog to me? Am I going to run away from the dog? Am I going to find a place of shelter or a treat to give the dog? And how am I going to act? How am I going to think about this? This is really the aggregates. So every time we see something, perceive something, taste, touch, think, there's the label that arises, and then there's the action, that kind of the potential action or the impulse to act arises with that. So this name and form, this nama rupa, has this mixture of label and potential action, all relating back to me, all tied into the sense of me, the sense of self. It's all part of this whole process. This is reflected in the classic image of nama rupa. So often in Tibetan tapestries, they have this beautiful graphic representation of dependent origination, with each link having a particular picture or graphic or image. So this one for nama rupa is depicted by a couple people in a boat, like in a little small rowboat, with one of them steering. Right? So the boat represents form and its occupants, the mental aggregates, the five aggregates. And I like this image of this boat that's occupied, because it has this sense of we're starting to come together from this kind of broad openness of consciousness that we spoke of last month to something narrowing down to a particular object that we're focusing on. And again, we just don't focus on it. We also start to do something with it. Could be as subtle as saying, I like that. Or something like an itch that we scratch. An impulse of movement of body, of mind, of speech. And so the sense of the boat being steered, that's where the steering starts to come through. We start to direct our attention, direct our actions based on that label that we've put to that. So this field of consciousness, this that we've talked about this last month, the previous month of March, is like this room that has certain parameters, the things that we pay attention to. Each area of consciousness has its things that it pays attention to, that it's receptive to, and also things that it excludes, that it doesn't pay attention to. What it allows in, what it doesn't allow. And each field has its bias toward a certain type of reactivity, toward longing, toward fear. And so when something enters that fear field, like the field of hearing, the consciousness of hearing, and I hear a sound, right? We recognize it. We automatically assign a label to it, a name to it. And we start to gear up to do something about it. You know, it could be, I'm irritated. I like that. Could be this whole host of things. This boat starts to be ready to move, to direct, to engage with life. And where does it go to? It goes into this field of suffering, into dependent origination. So let's look at this a little bit more closely with some examples to make it more concrete. So again, this sense of name is not a neutral identifier. It's really laden with our past history, with our past conceptions, and our past actions. Right? So this is the sankharas coming through. The power of ignorance and sankharas shaping the very way we perceive this moment. And the name itself starts to incline us toward action, toward doing something with. So let's take an example of a tree. So let's see, have you a tree, you know, growing in your yard or in a park or nearby your home. And when you see this tree, different things arise for different people. the name, the label differs, and what do they do with that name? That form also differs. A botanist might look at that and say, oh, that's a beautiful species of Douglas fir. And, you know what tree, what subspecies, what genus, this whole thing loads up in that person's mind. Or an arborist might look at it and say, wow, that branch is a little sickly. I need to trim up that or help it in this way or work on these diseases. A forester or a logger might look at it and say, well, how long till I can harvest that? How many board feet will I get out of that tree? Another person, let's say a homeowner, looks at it and says, well, that tree is lovely because it shades my home. Another homeowner might look at it and say, that tree blocks my view. I want to get rid of it. My grandfather, apparently, whenever he moved to a house, the first thing he would do would cut down all the trees in the front yard so they wouldn't get into his sewer. So that's another perception, another name that arises based on the same exact physical thing. We just perceive it very differently. Maybe a child looks at the tree and says, wow, this would be a great place for a treehouse or a swing. An environmentalist looks at it as a carbon reservoir and how it helps with taking up the excess carbon dioxide. Or maybe it looks at it as an invasive species that's crowding out native species. So this just the simple idea of a tree. I'm trying to pick something that's fairly benign. But please realize this same process happens in much more personal ways, much more significant ways in our lives. Even the sense of I who am having this experience, I am who having this thought, I am who is struggling in this difficult time. That's also name, that's also form, nama rupa. And in that name and form, there's the sense of what is being my sense of me and the actions that flow from that. So it can be very, very subtle and also a very profound practice if we start to let go of the label. We start to let go of the impulse to act from. So how we perceive really defines fundamentally how we act and how we relate to any experience. The boat is always being steered, is always being rowed one direction or another. So each of these different ways of relating to something has an impulse to act embedded in it. It's one and the same in this Namarupa section here. And this is where it starts to get a little tricky. Because when we see something like a tree, or we get a sense of maybe a spouse or a friend or a cat, whatever you like, it's not like we often can just sit back and ponder that for a little bit, like a pondering choice. Like, wow, it's not like we go through this process in our minds, like, wow, this is a very interesting experience. What should I call this? I think I'll call this a tree. Yeah. Now, how should I relate to it? Should I like it? Should I dislike it? Should I be neutral toward it? Maybe I'll cut it down, or maybe I'll water it. It's usually we don't have this kind of spread out, thoughtful process of pondering what to do with an experience. It's almost immediate, almost instantaneously, almost practically simultaneously with the seeing of it, all this other stuff becomes downloaded with it, like craving, liking more of, liking less of. That sense of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's like the slippery slope as dependent origination takes over. So it can be quite humbling when we see that, how quickly we go into the sense of reactivity, the sense of longing. Now near my house, we have this nice park. And sometimes every few years, we get enough snow in it that I can go cross-country skiing through that park. And there's this little hill that I like to go up. And I can kind of go up a little bit, or I can go up quite a bit. And of course, the further up I go, the faster I go down. So depending on the conditions and how brave I feel, I go up higher, I go down lower. So this example of this hill, I want to use that to kind of flush out this idea of potentiality, of the action that's embedded in the label. right? Because some names and form have a lot more potential motion in them, have a lot more potential reactivity, a lot more potential energy that's just waiting to come out, to be expressed. We all know this. We can hear many things in our life in a day that we just kind of have a mild response to. And then we hear that one phrase delivered in exactly the right way, and suddenly we're filled in a sense of reactivity. It's like we're triggered, we're hooked instantaneously from that. So that has a lot of potential energy. It's like we've created all these little ski hills in our psyche, if you will, in our conditioning. We've gone up these hills through our past history, our past experiences, different heights, sometimes just a little bit, sometimes quite a bit up. And then we just kind of leave those in the background. And we go about our day, our life, and suddenly we find ourselves strapped into our skis, staring downhill. And before we know it, we're rocketing down that hill, perhaps crashing into the tree if we're not careful, like I might. And so the sense of potentiality, it's like this a predisposition, potential actions that really shape our consciousness and shape the namarupa that arises from that. So as we go through life, the way that we act, the way we respond, sets up these preconditions. This is going back to the sankharas and back to ignorance, how those volitional activities, those volitional actions start to shape. It's like going up that ski hill. We don't know when that's going to manifest itself. So the good news is, the bad news is that we're going to find ourselves on those ski hills. The good news is we can, at that moment, shift from being reactive to responsive, using the practice itself to connect with something that's grounded in the moment, learning to shift our attention into something that allows us to land, to be present. So how do we practice with this namarupa? How do we practice easing our suffering? So our name or form generates this tendency for this manifestation of self. Okay, so again, this whole process, dependent origination, if you take one thing away, it's really describing how we create this sense of self, how we create the sense of I, the sense of me, the sense of you, the sense of yours, that sense of identification, right? So there's a relative truth to this. There's also an absolute truth that we're learning to see through. And tied to that sense of self is suffering. As we see much later in the year, as we finish up dependent origination, after we go through becoming, birth, there's old age, sickness, and death. There's pain, lamination, sorrow from that. And that conditions us into ignorance again. Then starts the cycle over. So the sense of self, in the each time a namarupa is activated, it's again countless times in a day, the sense of self starts to emerge in relationship to that. Okay, so it's not like there's this constant sense of me. We think there is. That's the illusion. But a sense of self arises again and again based on this namarupa. It arises and it passes away. So we may not see that sense of self. That's a subtle sting. It takes a fair amount of momentum of practice, a fair amount of urgency and sincerity to see the illusion of that. What we can do pretty easily is see the footprints of that self. We can see the manifestation of that, its actions. Anytime that we're finding ourselves being reactive, a sense of emotionality, there's a sense of self that's with that. I'm feeling scared. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling joyful. The sense of self has arisen with that. Anytime that I'm really opinionated, when I am definitely right and that other person is definitely wrong, that's the sense of self. It's the action of the sense of self. That's what it has to be there for that opinion to have that grip. Anytime I look out and say, there's me, and then there's you. A sense of separation, of distance. Walking in the park, and having people, you know, give you a wide berth. You know, it's like there's that sense of, and especially if they don't make eye contact and they kind of shy away from the potential infection that you might carry. It's that sense of otherness, that sense of separation, that sense of me versus you, right? The sense of self is expressing itself. We can see each of these examples has this sense of suffering that's inherent in that. Two, also when we're really doing well, when we're really happy or something, when life is going really well, we're just on cloud nine or whatever expression we want. What happens when that ends? When it ends, there's the suffering. So suffering arises either during the sense of self arising or the ending of that sense of self. Anytime there's a sense of craving, of wanting, of pride, of arrogance, or a sense of shame, of embarrassment, of being diminished in some way. These are really the obvious manifestations of this sense of I, of sense of me. There's, of course, much more subtle elements of this sense of self. That's that maybe that quiet sense of watcher, of witness. Something's observing this experience. That subtle sense of separation. Even when we're very quiet, there can be that subtle separation. All these have nama rupa embedded in them. All these have nama rupa as a fundamental piece to that cycle of dependent origination. You know, each one of them by itself is no problem. It's this leading from one stage to the other, one link to the other. So the point of practice is to understand what causes suffering, what arises suffering, and the cessation of that suffering. As I started the evening with, the Buddha once said that whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dharma, and whoever sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. So how do we interrupt this cycle of suffering? And each link, if you look closely at it, if we really explore it, provides a way of interrupting this process, of bringing it into a quality of awareness, of knowing, of clarity of mind. As a way of seeing through it, into it. So last month with consciousness, we practiced this by how consciousness can kind of get this exclusive quality of something that's really gripping, like maybe a painful thing in our bodies or a painful mind state. And intentionally shifting the field of consciousness from that contracted quality to something that is more neutral and spacious. Or as I talked about last week, this broadening of our attention, of our consciousness, to something that is including all levels of consciousness in an equal, non-clinging way, in a way that's not feeding back into the sense of self. So how can we use nama rupa in the same way, the same gateway into practice? So nama rupa is our conditioning, our history, our past experiences will present a default nama rupa for us. Okay, we don't have to worry about that. That will just pop up. And you listen to something, how quickly does the mind say, okay, that's a plane, that's a siren. See a bird, how quickly does our mind say, okay, that's a bird. Okay, it's almost instantaneous. Now, if you look closely with that arising, there sometimes is a bit of an action with that. The stronger the situation or the experience, the stronger that reactivity will be, that impulse to act. So the real issue isn't that we have these labels that come up, right? We need those labels to be able to navigate the world, to be able to know how to do our jobs or how to relate to another person, how to cook dinner, whatever it might be. The real issue is that we take this relative reality of nama rupa as an absolute reality. So we take the relative reality that our mind presents itself, this relative label, and we take that as being absolutely true, including the actions that arise from that, and including the sense of self that arises from that. When we take that as absolutely true, that's when we're into trouble. That's when we suffer. When we say, this is the truth. You know, my name and form, my nama rupa are absolutely correct and accurate. And of course, that means yours, if they're different, are not. Right? I mean, how often do we do this? And say, yeah, you just don't know what you're talking about. That's that sense of opinionation. That's that sense of self is manifesting itself. It's expressing itself. So therefore, my actions that flow from that conviction are absolutely correct too. And also the background sense of me is also reality. And we suffer and cause others to suffer through that. Now this, when you reflect on this, this is the source of probably all interpersonal strife, whether it's just you and your loved ones, you and your family, you and strangers, countries against countries, races against races, or however we distinguish ourselves, however we create the sense of other. This is the source. Going back to the example of the tree, when the logger looks at the tree and says, you know, I want it to cut that down. And the environmentalist says, no, we cannot. There's this complete clash of nama rupa. Both are correct in their minds. Both are correct, relatively correct. So let's play with this a little bit. Let's explore this a little bit more. So our conditioning gives us a nama rupa, a name and form. It's our label, and it's the impulse to do something with that label. So what we can do with this is practice shifting from one name and form to another. Like the tree example, you can see what impulses flow from the child who looks at it and see the tree house versus the homeowner who sees something that shades their house. And this is a fun process to do. This is part of the homework for this week, is to do this with something that triggers a mild reaction in your life. So let's say, for example, that you're stuck at home for weeks at a time. This is hypothetically speaking. And you like to have a clean kitchen table. And you just spend some time just tidying it up, making it really, you know, pristine. You go for a walk and you come back and there's this puzzle, this 1,000-piece puzzle laid out on it, right? And let's say, for example, that you really aren't a puzzle person, that you grew up, your parents didn't like puzzles. I don't think I say this person has never played a puzzle. Don't know if we even had a puzzle growing up. So what kind of nama rupa is going to arise from seeing that puzzle, right? It's going to be embedded with my conditioning, with our preference, my past actions, cleaning the table and the reactivity around puzzles. So this label of puzzle, this seeing puzzle, is, again, it's not neutral. It's not unbiased. It's anything but that. It's embedded with a quality of aversion. Or more accurately, it's embedded with the potentiality for aversion, with reactivity. That sight will be unpleasant. You know, I could rant and rave. This is this invitation of the self trying to express itself through its control. So to work with that, say instead of going down that pathway, that invitation of being reactive, there's simply a pause of after seeing the puzzle. Noticing the flow of the nama rupa, the flow of name, the name and the impulse to arise from that. Meeting it with awareness, meeting it with mindfulness, meeting it with compassion, noticing in the body, noticing the emotionality, noticing with a quality of tenderness, owning someone's own reactivity. Now from that place, this is where the play comes in. What if I met this with a different nama rupa? If I just imagine a different nama rupa was arising. Let's say there's a member of the family who loved puzzles, who grew up with puzzles, has many fond memories of doing puzzles with family members around holidays and just that camaraderie, that companionship, that engagement of working on something together and the chit chat and the, you know, hunting for the right piece. So when this a person with that kind of a history, that kind of a background sees the puzzle, there's a sense of joy that arises. There's a sense of love that arises and anticipation. You know, so it's a very completely different nama rupa that arises from the exact same thing. Isn't that interesting? And if I say I'm right and you're wrong, I'm tying myself to suffering. So imagining that perspective, you may even find yourself stepping into it, playing with that. Well, what if I play with puzzle? Maybe it's fun to be there and to try this out, enjoying working together, the challenge, the, you know, the little bit of frustration, the patience, the friendship, companionship, the sense of connection. So what we just did in that example, and I invite you to practice this in your own life, in your own way this week, is to find something that makes a little bit of reactivity. And instead of going down the righteousness, the sense of I am right, to step back, feel that nama rupa manifesting, feeling the impulse to act, and just pausing with it. Pausing with it. And in that pause, it's entertaining, it's playing with the mind, saying, what if a different nama rupa was possible? A different person's perspective. Stepping in another person's shoes, as they say. So what we're doing in, by this is we're learning to practice for shifting from one nama rupa to another, shifting from the inherent actions that flow from that label. Now, by doing this, this starts to teach us how our truth is not the ultimate truth. Our truth is just relative. This starts to loosen up the selfing that goes down the line. We start to see the self is not so solid. If I can shift it, if I can actually entertain another person's point of view, another person's nama rupa as being equally valid, equally true, then I don't hold my own so strongly. I hold mine with a more of a sense of ease, a sense of fluidity. We start to see that that sense of meanness, a sense of self, is not so solid. If it can change so quickly, it starts to show us the emptiness inherent in something we take as being solid and unchanging. This is the difficulty of nama rupa. It's so convincing because our history just makes our whole senses, our whole very way of perceiving, ready and primed to feel that. We're up on that ski slope and we're feeling that reactivity. So it has to be true, right? Because I'm feeling that reactivity. And as Dharma students, we start to pierce through that illusion. We start to see the origination of suffering. So practicing this in small ways, in easy ways, is so helpful. You know, don't practicing with the person who causes the most reactivity or the thing that you're most passionate about. Start with small ways. Because the small way teaches you the process. The heat is down low enough, the temperature is low enough, the reactivity is low enough, that you can have that spaciousness. That spaciousness allows you to see through. But that seeing the process, seeing through, then you can start to make that seen in the much more pertinent, much more reactive areas of our life. So starting small, letting that teach you these lessons in easy ways, then you can bring that to the bigger lessons of life. So I'd like to just finish up with one of the biggest things that trips up our practice around this. One of the biggest difficulties, the self-imposed difficulty we have as Dharma practitioners, especially in its integration with daily life. And that is that we believe our nama rupa is the right one. We believe are in the only right one. You know, in this particular situation, I can see it in a lot of areas, but this one area, of course, I am right. Everyone else who has different ideas is wrong. This shows up in particular areas of polarization, of politics, of religion, of environment. And deep, deep down, we know that I am right. And anyone who's not on my side of the camp is wrong. Period. There's just this conviction that we have. And this is often the question that comes up. What about, you know, this issue or that issue? So the way to start to work with this, and because really the deep belief here is that releasing my point of view means abandoning what's true. If I release this deeply held point of view, I'm abandoning what's actually true. Now, from a Dharmist perspective, we confuse what's happening is we're confusing what is relatively true for what is absolutely true. This relative versus absolute truth. So relative is always going to be based upon conditions. What's relatively true for me will not be relatively true for you. This is just the reality of being human beings. You know, absolute reality, though, is beyond conditions. It's beyond ideas, beyond concepts. It's beyond greed, beyond hatred, beyond delusion. It's beyond self and other. One of my favorite lines from Rumi points to this so clearly, that out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And when the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Rumi is pointing toward the absolute when the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase doesn't make any sense. So for our practice to really find this place of reconciling this relative and absolute is we have to learn to hold them both. Now, when we're caught just in the relative, we're just caught in our opinionation, no matter how true we think it's to be, we're caught in suffering. When we're caught in the relative, there's no perspective of the absolute. The more right we feel, the more wrong we think you are, the other person is, the more suffering we'll have. And the more suffering we'll inflict on another person. On the other hand, if we're caught in the absolute, it's really hard to function in life. You know, we need this relative to navigate the world, to how to make a living, how to cook our dinner, how to have relationships, how to have active, skillful actions in the world around these very important social and environmental issues. This is absolutely true. And yet when the relative becomes informed by the absolute, and we have a taste of the absolute, as we do if we release nama rupa and fall into this deep stillness that's beyond self, then the relative arises, but it's informed by this perspective of the absolute. There's a fluidity and ease that starts to flow. There's a skillfulness that just arises naturally. There's an appropriate action that's not based on our reactivity, but actually being very deeply connected. We're able to work with people across the aisle because we are able to pick up our nama rupa and invest in it and also release it equally. So learning to live in a relative world full of relative truths, you know, full of nama rupas that present themselves, that manifest, but we're informed by the absolute, what is unconditioned, what's outside of dependent origination, what's outside of suffering. Then if we act from that nama rupa, if it's skillful, but never forgetting it's inherently empty, we find ourselves releasing back into the absolute as soon as that nama rupa passes. In this way, we're meeting life, not from our reactivity, not from our conditioning, but really from our heart. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and wrong and right, let me start again. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. All right, if we could just sit quietly together for a few moments. All right, thank you for your engagement. So we have some time for some questions and answers or some discussion. I'll let you kind of ponder that for a moment. And what you can do to ask a question, probably the best way is to go down to the bottom of your screen. And in the center right, there's a chat bubble. If you click the chat bubble, you can then send a chat to everyone. It's probably the best way to do it. And that way, Khaled, who's the technical support tonight, if you see that, you can unmute that person, and then we can dialogue. I do want to share with you the homework and practice and reflection for tonight and this week. And I'll send that as a chat. Okay. So to read that to you, that we can think of nama rupa, or name and form, as the label we place on something and the impulse to act relative to that label. This often becomes a fast trip into reactivity and wanting. It's that ski hill that we're on the top of the hill and we find ourselves zooming down it. So practice pausing when you find yourself in a state of reactivity, when the sense of self is manifesting, is acting out. What label are you assigning to the target of reactivity? So try to kind of go back and say, okay, what's the one thing that triggered this? What's the sound, the smell, the sensation, the thought that led to this moment of reactivity? Notice what label, how am I labeling that? What's the exactness of that? And what is the action that's embedded in that? And as you do this process, notice how it lands in the body, feeling the quality of compassion, the quality of holding this experience. And then this is where the play comes in, the sense of curiosity. Can you imagine a different conditioning around that object, a different thing, that different history, a different thing that would arise, a different name and form? Okay, so it might still be a tree, but maybe instead of seeing something that's blocking your house, the sunlight, and blocking your view, maybe seeing it as something that brings joy to birds and habitat for birds. And just see if that starts to shift your reactivity. And in shifting the reactivity, is it shift that sense of self? So we'll explore that this week and then come back next week for a shorter recap of this talk and a small group exploration of that. All right, so it looks like there's a question from Deb. Yeah, so try to go to everybody so Khaled can see, but I'll try to find Deb here and meet you. There you are, Deb. Okay, Deb, looks like you're unmuted already. Your question was, is there always suffering associated with recognizing self and other? Isn't it sometimes protective? Are you there, Deb?
I am. Here I am. Yeah.
Hey, Deb.
Hey. So in particular, this is what I was thinking about when I asked the question. So I was on my bicycle today on the Burke Gilman Trail. This was a lovely day. And of course, there's other riders out on the trail too. And I do want to know where these other people are. I want to know there's a bike coming up on my left-hand side. I want to know there's someone coming down the trail because I don't want to have a collision.
Yes.
And so it seemed to me then that I am recognizing myself and others, of course, because I'm on a bike and they're on a bike.
Yes.
And I don't want to have a crash.
Right.
But the suffering really would happen if there was a crash. So it seemed to me like by my recognizing myself and these other cyclists, that is more of a protective action in essence.
Yes. Yeah, that's a nice question, because there's a sense of self which is helpful, that's functional. And I remember Christina Feldman talking about it as the navigational self, that you engage and you have that sense of protection, for example, like your example of seeing where the bikes are and learning, okay, I've got to go this way or that way. That's very appropriate. It's very essential for us. It's a little bit like if we put on a particular uniform, like let's say we're a firefighter and we use that to go into a burning building. Okay, then that's appropriate. That's a sense of self that's helpful there. The trouble is if we take that bunker gear and we wear it all the time, and we try to go swimming in it, and we go to a fancy restaurant in it, we don't let that sense of self go. So back to your example, so if you have that sense of noticing, okay, I'm getting too close to this bike and I need to adjust, that's just an appropriate response, right? So there's the sense of self and the suffering with it is very minimal, right? It's very small. Let's take that same example and let's say after you had a near collision, you spent the next half hour fuming about it and writing a letter to whoever about complaining about it. Then the sense of self has gone more into suffering. So I think that the sense of self, especially when it's more in a navigational mode, the suffering is very quiet. There is still some suffering because there's still that sense of separation. That sense of isolation. It's a quiet suffering, but it's still there. This is something that, especially as our practice becomes much more concentrated, much more deep, and we can have that sense of self fall away, and the sense of ease that comes from that, you can see that by contrast. But having that sense of a navigational self, that sense of, okay, I'm going to just adjust this way, or I'm going to make sure there's not a collision. Yeah, that's for most of us, for most of the time, that's very helpful. Does that make sense? I can't tell if I'm confusing you more.
No, it certainly makes sense to me to want to avoid collisions. But I will tell you that also on the trail today, a rider was coming towards me and I thought he was going much too fast for conditions. So you can always hear already my judgment about that. Like,
that's right.
This guy needs to slow down. He is going way too fast. You know, it's dangerous. And so I could see how that irritation that I had with him would be part of my suffering.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that sense of, you know, but there's also the discernment, right? There's discernment. It's like the sense of self, you know, there's discernment. All kind of gets mixed together. And sometimes we also look at this process that the personality somehow falls away and isn't there anymore. I mean, I think it was Nausagada said that the personality is like a shadow. It's still always there. It just is not believed in. There can be still that moment of anger, that moment of reactivity, but it falls away much quicker. Yeah. Yeah, so we're... In this context, I think it's more helpful to see when we get kind of caught in that reactivity, when we get invested, we kind of stake our claim, right?
Yeah.
When it's a little bit more obvious.
Yeah.
And so the subtle quality of suffering with what you're describing of just appropriate change of protection is it's pretty subtle to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Deb. All right, so it looks like we have Judith. Oh, you don't see the homework in the chat. Did anyone see the chat homework? Let me send it again. Okay, I might have just sent that to one person. Does everybody see it now? Okay, good. I see some nods. All right. So that was Deb. Who's next? Okay, Janet. Janet S. I think you said the sensation of joy is reactivity is selfing also. Can you say more? If I heard wrong, ignore. Okay. So, Janet, are you unmuted or would you like to talk?
I don't really have anything to add. I mean, if I wasn't listening quickly enough or something.
No, yeah, I definitely said that. That the sense of, and there's different kinds of joy too. It's a little bit like Deb's question, that there's that there's like relative levels of suffering. You know, sometimes it's a small little bit of suffering, and sometimes it's a very large suffering. And we're in a sense of joy, it can take us either ways, because joy is part of, you know, part of this process is this unbinding of the heart. And that there's a joy that's outside of conditions. The more that the joy is tied to conditions, the more suffering there's going to be, right? Because those conditions are going to change. But if there's a joy of just simply being alive or simply being present, that joy has a very subtle or no sense of self arising with it. But if I'm really joyful because I just want $1 million, it's a conditioned joy, you know, or I just found out my COVID diagnosis, my test was negative. You know, there's a sense of relativeness to that. And so the joy in the midst of it, it feels like it's happy. But what happens when that joy falls away and the conditions change? That's where the suffering is. So sometimes we have the suffering while we're in that sense of self, and sometimes after the sense of self changes to the next sense of self. Does that make sense? Yeah. Thank you, Janet. All right. Okay, so Brooke. Oh, okay, so two things about the homework. So it looks like it took care of that, I hope. And then all right, anyone else have anything to say? Or questions or anything that you'd like to explore?
I have a question.
Yes. Is that Valerie?
Yes. Hi there. I wanted to clarify. So once you start working with the relative and the absolute starts to appear, it feels like it seems more in relation to a virtue or a skillful means. That's the way I interpret it. Could you clarify?
So let me make sure I got that correct. So you're saying that when you start to work with the relative versus absolute, mm-hmm. the absolute seems to be more tied with a virtue?
A virtue or skillful means.
Yeah, virtue or skillful means. Let me think about that. That's not a way that I naturally think about it, but I think you may be correct in that. That they're absolute. Well, there's different gateways. Let's say it this way. So the absolute, we can see it through a point of inquiry, a point of wisdom, of just seeing things very, very deeply, that the absolute appears. You know, we see the relativeness, and we see that, seeing that finally the illusion of that, and what's left is the absolute. Now, that being said, so once, you know, once you touch the absolute, then that those skillful means become more natural. But relative, you know, the sense of the skillful means or the sense of virtuous action, it inherently tends to incline us toward the absolute. Because when we're not acting in a kind way, let's say, or acting from a way of harm, we're really further invested in that sense of relativeness. We're really further invested in that sense of me versus you, for example. Well, if I act from a sense of generosity, a sense of kindness, that's inclining me toward interconnection. Okay, it's stepping out of that relative self-focused nama-rupa to that sense of, okay, other people have needs, other people have experiences that I want to meet with compassion and with skill. And so in that way, yeah, the absolute can be a beautiful gateway. Or that you say the skillful actions and the virtuous actions, the precepts can be a beautiful gateway into that absolute. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Valerie. All right, anyone else?
Tim?
Yes. Hi, Susan.
Tim, so I am looking back at your comment of form flows from name And I'm just checking this out. So the aggregates are the place where the potentiality is, because that's where I'm looking at my perceptions, and I mean, I'm examining them, yes, pausing at that point of perception where I don't want to complicate things, but like my language gets in the way, and that's what I'm perceiving from. So is that where the potentiality is you're talking about? And did I understand that the form flows from the name and the aggregates lie in that?
Yeah, there's different ways of kind of explaining Namarupa. And, you know, one way is the aggregates is another way of describing the aggregates. That the Buddha would say those are one and the same at some times.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. And the aggregates, I mean, that's a whole subject in itself.
Right.
And if you look at it, the aggregates contain some of the links of dependent origination, like, you know, contact and feeling tone and sankharas. And so it gets a little confusing about how they all relate, because it's almost more of a hologram that we're going through this in a linear process, but it's much more like you touch one element and you're touching all these at the same time. So it's much more kind of intertwined, then, you know, it takes a while to comprehend that. But if we come back to I kind of simplified the whole process, that we see something, we sense something, hear something, taste something, there's that sense of knowing. And inherent with that, there's this quality of reactivity or impulse to do something with. It could be very subtle, could be very quiet, or it could be much more pronounced. And that's really a description of the aggregates and how they kind of churn around with each other, of you know, consciousness and perception and volition, and all these things churn around.
I'm curious about sometimes language falls from perception when, you know, you're looking at a tree and you see the label, but then something else happens. It's like you lose that form. Is that a place to be curious about? Or I mean, is that a place to notice? Because that's when you're losing that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's like when you see a tree, you can see the tree and then you can see what the idea of tree is pointing toward. Right? So you can let the label, the sense of identification of the tree fall away. So you're just directly experiencing this thing we call a tree. This is the bare attention. And this is what's something that we try to cultivate all the time as meditators, is what's the direct experience? What's the bare experience? Not my interpretation of it, not my label of it. So this is a very practical way of working with Namarupa, is learning to, there's a label and we can drop that and direct. And when we do that, there can be this sense of deep connection, the sense of stillness, the sense of ease that comes from that connecting, not through our ideas or our labels or our reactivity, but the actual essence of what's being seen, sensed, felt, etc.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right, looks like Kathy. What about meeting someone and feeling they might harm you, walk too close, act ambiguously? Are we one and the same as this person about to rob us? Okay, so that's, you know, it's a great question, because it goes back to that relative versus absolute. And this is this kind of the sticking point that we often get to, that, you know, there's these examples like if I'm one with everything, then everyone's going to take my possessions or harm me. So it's this relativeness, this relative application of the sense of self, the sense of seeing the bike coming at you at the Burke Gilman and being willing to get off the trail or to adjust or to be cautious, to have discernment, right? So that's that sense of knowing that. And, you know, so there's like acknowledging that there is this relative truth of separation. There is a relative truth that not everyone has your best interest in heart. You know, this is a fact of life. And yet there's also this absolute knowing that there's this much deeper connection that transcends what people's actions are. You know, as I think Sylvia Bornstein said, you know, you can throw someone out of your life, but don't throw them out of your heart. You know, so it can be that sense of saying no, that's the sense of asserting boundaries or doing a restraining order or whatever it might take to keep the sense of safety. And yet there can still be this paradox of interconnection, this paradox of non-separation. And it's a difficult thing to see and work with. And yet when we hear that, we recognize it. We recognize the inspirational nature of that. Does that help, Kathy? Okay, I don't know if you can't get unmuted. Let's see what else is here.
Oh, it looks like I'm unmuted.
Oh, there you are, Cheryl.
Okay. I was thinking about conditions, you know, how our conditions, you know, help us to feel like maybe somebody's going to rob us or whatever. And in my case, you know, maybe I might have made a bad decision because of trauma earlier in my life or something like mm-hmm. that. So there's so many things going on, and sometimes it's really hard to see them. And I guess the only time that we do see them is when we're in the middle of them. And then somehow or other, if we're making the effort, I suppose we can shake ourselves out of it. But sometimes I think we need help. To see out from that kind of condition.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, I don't want to discount the power of the sankharas, the power of our conditioning. And that often that is so, it can be so overwhelming, especially with trauma, with you know, archaic family issues. All these things can have such a strong grip on us that learning to work skillfully with them are very helpful. You know, to take that sense of self that feels so battered, so hurt, and learning how to find a place of ease within that sense of self.
But even beyond that, to get stuck in, you know, you're making a decision about something, and even you haven't thought about this particular trauma in, you know, forever, but suddenly it's up for you.
Yes.
And so, you know, do you believe it? Is that's name and form right there, isn't it? And yeah. So either you believe it or, you know, you check it out with somebody, you know, I think for me, you know, sometimes you just have to check this stuff out with, you know, or just believe it and make a decision from there without, you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So I think having someone you trust, whether it's a professional or a dear friend, to say, you know, this is what I'm experiencing. And does that seem like that's off or not? Because sometimes our perception, it gets so clouded. It gets so, you know, nama rupa upon nama rupa. And it was just such a you know, yeah. It's like more, you know, that power of ignorance, right? Ignorance is leading to consciousness. You know, it's like this whole quality. And it can be helpful to have that. And that's where ideally we have those people in our lives, whether it's professionals or dear friends or spouses, that we can check things out, that we can trust to have really honest feedback that's still coming from a place of care for us. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of Sangha.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the power of Sangha.
Yeah. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Tim. Oops.
All right. So I appreciate the questions coming in. We do have a few announcements. So let's see if I can get as many of these as we can here. Okay, I think we got Cheryl. Katie asked for Zelly, and I just sent that out in the group chat, I hope. Yes. Okay, Sarah. Actually, yeah, let's go back to Sarah and then go to Allison. So Sarah says, because the robbers living in their own relative existence of name and form. They have this belief in their name and form that is so strong that they discount other people's, you know, right to be safe, to have their bodies not be violated, not to have their possessions stolen. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's him. I have a follow-up to that, yeah. Which is, in knowing that that is, they're living in that relativity, how to have generosity, and not necessarily someone who is about to cause you immediate harm, but just like in general with people you interact with who are negative or who are difficult or present as difficult. Like, I can conceptualize that they're in their name and form, but how do I really cultivate generosity towards that?
Yeah, so that's really the heartfelt question, is how do you cultivate that sense of compassion, of generosity, of connection with someone who's coming from a destructive place? You know, how do you find that? I think it's often helpful just to reflect on, you know, people who are persecutors, who are causing harm, how much harm they've experienced in their own lives. You know, how separate they have to be from their own hearts to be able, being able to hurt another person, and how what causes that sense of divide, of separation, what kind of experiences they might have had. You know, maybe relating to them not as the kind of the scary adult-sized individual, but maybe them as a small child who were helpless and victimized themselves. So that can be one gateway into that. Another way is to maybe talk to someone who's worked through that, who's been able to come from that violent background, that criminal background, but has been able to turn their life around and see what is their perspective about? How do they see how they acted and where that pain was coming from? But it's definitely one of the more challenging things we have to do. Thank you, Sarah. So I want to just get to Allison's question, and then we have our announcements. So Allison says, suppose we perceive something and label it as someone else's sorrow or suffering. And the initial reaction in the mind and heart is to take action and share metta, or take actions we believe are kind. Are there further investigation to take even in these moments that can teach us more about Namarupa and how it contributes to suffering? Well, that's an interesting question there. And so, Allison, a lot of it has to do with, you know, knowing yourself. Is that sense of compassion, you know, when that arises, you know, to share metta, is it coming from any sense of disease, a sense of wanting to separate from? Because we can connect with love, or we can also disconnect with love. You know, so start to say, to notice, you know, just notice that sense of investigation as you suggested. You know, when I feel that urge to be generous, is there a sense of unease with the fact that this person is suffering? Is there a sense of not able to tolerate that they are suffering? Because sometimes suffering is the best teacher. It is what teaches us in a way that's much deeper than any lesson. And sometimes, you know, that suffering needs action, it needs compassion, and sometimes it needs just witnessing. So that's what I would suggest there, is just to know yourself, to pause and to take a deep inventory of any subtle qualities of Namarupa, of impulse, of uncomfortableness that the metta or the compassion is kind of trying to alleviate. It's probably a better reaction to have than most. And by looking at it in that way, you can maybe find a deeper expression of that kindness. Does that help, Allison?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. Very helpful.
You're welcome. All right, if you could just stay for a few more minutes, and then Iris has a few announcements, and then we'll have a chance for everybody to say goodbye as we end.